Questions don't get any bigger than this one. What is life? How we define life is the basis of some of our thorniest ethical issues, like abortion and medical research and the right to die. Award-winning New York Times science columnist Carl Zimmer has never been afraid of grasping the nettle, asking the questions that don't have simple, neat answers and that baffle even the greatest minds in science. His latest book takes us on a journey into the borderlands between living and not. It's called Life's Edge, The Search for What It Means to Be Alive, and Carl Zimmer joins us now. Hi.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Good to chat to you. And life for this book began as a podcast. What is life? Is this a question you felt needed to be answered or needed to be asked?
I think it's a question that we all wonder, and maybe when we're children, we ask our parents and they don't give us very good answers. And then when we grow up, we discover that scientists kind of struggle with it as well. As a journalist, I specialize in writing about biology and medicine. And, every now and then you step back and try to think, well, what actually sets all this living stuff apart from the non-living world? And it's really kind of hard to draw a line.
Lots of New Zealanders listening will recall in science class, maybe you do this in the US as well, Mrs. C. Green, that little acronym, or maybe it's mnemonic that teaches you all the things to look for the characteristics of life. What's wrong with that as a definition?
Well, it's a catalog. It's not really a definition. If you go to one person and ask them for the list of criteria for life, it might not be the same as somebody else. And people may put different priorities and different emphasis on different things in the list. Lists are not a good way to think deeply about things in science. In 1500, if you had asked an alchemist, well, what is water? What's your definition of water? They'd say, well, water is something that's transparent and it's something that's wet and it's something that certain things dissolve in. That's literally how people define water. But the problem then was, well, there seem to be different kinds of water that are transparent and wet, but dissolve different things. And so they would refer to some as noble water. And at the same time, you might say, well, what happens when it gets really cold in the winter and a lake freezes and now you have ice? And they might say, well, that's not water anymore because it doesn't fit the list anymore. So, really these kinds of lists actually get you into deep, deep trouble. You end up arguing about whether, say, viruses are alive or not. And what science really needs to move towards is an actual theory of life, in the same way that alchemists needed to become chemists and develop a theory of matter so that they could say, well, let's talk about molecules, let's talk about atoms. Now I can look at water in a whole new light. Just trying to come up with a better definition before the theory is really a waste of time.
There's a bit of a difference there in that water, or possibly a difference in that water is a physical, observable object, whereas life is arguably an abstract notion.
Well, it feels abstract, but it's abstract in the sense that organization is abstract. It's maybe not something that you can hold in your hand, but it is certainly something that is part of the natural world. I mean, the way I've been thinking about it recently is superconductivity. So that might seem abstract, but it is a property of matter, that there's certain conditions in which certain materials lose their resistance to an electric current. And when it was first discovered in the early 1900s, it seemed strange and arbitrary, and nobody could really explain it. Einstein trying to explain it, and he couldn't. And then eventually some other physicists did. They had a theory of superconductivity, and it sort of explains how it is that electrons start to move in interesting ways in certain materials. And from that, there's a whole science of superconductivity that has blossomed. you know, I don't think that life is, I don't think life is an abstraction. I think that it is one of the most interesting properties of matter that we know of, but we just don't understand it at a theoretical level yet.
You spoke to one philosopher who told you there's no point in searching for a definition, that it's bad for science. What was Carol's perspective?
Yeah, this is Carol Cleland of the University of Colorado. She, you know, she has been wrestling with some of these big questions for a long time now. You know, she actually was involved with some of NASA's first astrobiology projects. You can kind of consider her like an in-house philosopher for NASA. Mm-hmm. And he points out how definitions have a very particular function in logic and in philosophy. And when people try to define life, they're making just a fundamental mistake. Life is something to be studied, to be understood, not to be defined. One of the hazards that she points out is that if we focus on simply trying to define life by some list, without a deep understanding of life, NASA can, or humanity in general, could get into a lot of trouble trying to look for life elsewhere in the universe. Because if we rigidly define it with a list that's really just based on life as we know it, then we might encounter life in a different form and not recognize it at all. Mm-hmm. So we have to allow ourselves to be more open to surprises, strange forms of chemistry that are going to challenge us to think more deeply about life.
Do you agree with Edgar Allan Poe, who said or wrote that, quote, the boundaries which divide life from death are at best shadowy and vague?
Yeah, so Edgar Allan Poe wrote that writing a short story, kind of a horror story about, you know, premature burial. And it's interesting how frightened people in the 19th century were about being accidentally buried alive. And this actually sort of spoke to medicine's poor grasp of the transition from life to death. You know, there were clearly situations where people were just dead and that was that, but there would be other more difficult cases where there was no like automatic test that you could use to determine if someone was dead. And so there was great anxiety, and, you know, people would actually rig up bells on strings to be connected to coffins just in case someone came back to life. And in a way, you know, and now, you know, we have better ways of determining when people do indeed die. But on the other hand, we have technology that in a way kind of expands that borderland between life and death. We have ventilators, for example, and you have these situations where people have, you know, their metabolism is still working, their heart is still beating, their brain is no longer functioning. And, you know, if we define brain death as death, we get into this awkward situation where, you know, the rest of the body, at least for a time, is still functioning. And I write in the book about one particularly poignant case where a girl named Jai McMath in California was put on a ventilator and was declared dead in California. Her mother did not want this to happen. And she ended up being flown to another state in the United States that had different rules. And she survived on a ventilator for a few years, actually went through puberty, eventually, you know, sadly died. But you have this paradoxical situation in which this girl received two death certificates, because sometimes it's very hard to decide when someone has actually died.
You came across, by the way, if you've just tuned in, I'm speaking with New York Times science journalist Carl Zimmer, whose book is called Life's Edge, The Search for What It Means to Be Alive. And you ran into some modern-day Dr. Frankensteins who were creating mini brains out of neurons in the lab. How are they an instructive way to look at this question?
I think, on a fundamental level, one reason that we wrestle with what it means to be alive is because, each of us think about our own lives, that we are alive. We are aware that we are alive. And that sort of fundamental intuition of our own lives, I think it gets us into trouble because we think it's easy to tell whether other things are alive or not, that it's easy to tell when lives begin and end. And so, we very much have a, certainly in the United States, a very pitched political battle about the when life begins. And that leads to, there have been a lot of challenges to a woman's right to an abortion. Mm. Because of this, and you actually have people who will declare, life begins at conception, and this is an idea that's been circulated in the United States at least since the 1800s, and it's very problematic because those cells that produce a fertilized embryo are themselves live in the sense that they metabolize, they respond to their environment. So if you're looking for life, it's already there. It does not begin with conception. And people may say, oh, well, what I mean is that a life begins, a distinct human life. And then the question is, well, what sets that life apart? And people will sometimes claim that it has to do with how the genome gets assembled, but that does not happen all at once. And then even after the embryo develops, it can split apart and you can have twins, you can have chimeras where embryos come together. So these sort of simple, glib ways of talking about life starting at conception, they really, in my view, from the evidence, they all fall apart. And I think that things get even more complex as scientists learn how to manipulate cells. So in Life's Edge, I go to visit the scientists who, as you mentioned, essentially are growing miniature human brains in petri dishes. They're called brain organoids. And at this point, what they can do is they can take a skin cell from you. Now you're alive, right? Mm. And they take a skin cell that's alive, put it in a petri dish, give it nutrients, still alive. And then they can add chemicals to it, which basically convert it into a cell that acts a lot like embryonic cells. Give it some more chemicals, it starts to turn into a neuron, as you would find in a human embryo, and that can develop into 100,000 or a million neurons, all interconnected very much like in parts of the human brain. And it produces things, electrical activity that seems like brain waves. So if we think of our brains as being central to a human life, well, there's something here in these dishes, which, bioethicists say, we need to be really careful about, because they could take on things that we think of as distinctive to a human life. But, there was no moment at which that thing suddenly became to life. It started out as part of your body.
Do we have moral obligations to those many brains?
We don't know yet. The National Academy of Sciences here in the United States is actually, having a meeting to start to address some of these questions. They're very important for studying the first stages of brain development. They could be potentially really important for understanding autism, for example, which is a developmental condition. So scientifically speaking, brain organoids are really important, but if scientists get better at growing them and sort of nurturing their complexity as brain-like things, might they one day unexpectedly start to learn, who knows? So we do have to figure out, well, what would constitute a situation where we owe these things certain, ethical debts? When does that begin? I don't think anybody can say. I don't think that we would say that a skin cell in a dish, really, you know, would that we owe something to that? But when does a brain organoid require our sort of a moral obligation? We don't have an answer yet.
Are viruses alive, Carl?
It depends on the virologist you talk to. You know, I literally one morning had a virologist email me and tell me emphatically that, of course, viruses are not alive. And any expert I talk to will tell me that. And then that afternoon, another virologist emailed me just out of the blue and told me that viruses are, of course, alive and that any expert would tell me that. So I'm not sure that I, as a writer, am ready to, you know, adjudicate this one. I don't know if I can settle it when the scientists themselves are so divided. The thing is that viruses, in some respects, do the things we think of in living things incredibly well. You know, the COVID-19 pandemic is a demonstration of viruses evolving remarkably well. And now we have these new variants that are evolving that are causing us additional trouble. Viruses are very good at replicating. They have lots of adaptations for getting around our immune systems. So all that seems to go into the category of, yes, alive. But if you require, say, something to be able to grow, to feed, well, viruses don't do that. They deliver virus genes into host cells, and then the cells themselves make new viruses. So they don't fit that particular requirement. So if that's essential to you, then I suppose they're not alive. But they have such a profound impact on all of life that it would seem strange that something that was not alive could have that effect.
Bats are known to be vectors for viruses, but that wasn't the reason you found yourself deep inside a bat cave for this book.
Yes, that's right. You know, for the book, you know, I sort of decided to explore life and to get to know some species that really show some of the hallmarks of life, are really exemplary that way. And so one important hallmark that scientists often talk about is homeostasis, which is basically being able to keep a sort of an inner balance. So even as your surroundings are changing, because you're alive, you're able to maintain a very complex stability inside of you, a dynamic stability. Your blood, your temperature stays the same, your blood sugar levels stay the same, and so on. But bats, I find, are just really impressive on this score. You know, they maintain a balance, you know, as they're flying around and generating huge amounts of heat. They dump that heat out. And then in northern areas, they survive the winter hibernating. So they shift their homeostasis to a totally new level. So I went into an abandoned mine with some conservation biologists, some wildlife biologists, to see what it's like for these bats to basically find a new inner balance that gets them through the winter, mostly sleeping their way through it. Sadly, in the United States, we have a fungus that is decimating bat populations. It's called white nose syndrome, the disease. And it's a disease of homeostasis, because what happens is the fungus, it likes to grow in the cold. And so while these bats are trying to hibernate, the fungus forces them to wake up from time to time because they're losing water. They need to drink. Their immune systems have to fight off the fungus. Sometimes they try to go eat outside. They fly into the snow and die off. It's really quite tragic. So bats seem like the perfect thing to explore for this particular hallmark of life.
There are snakes in the book too, and for tardigrade fans, also special mention of them, but we'll have to leave you to discover it for yourself because we're out of time with Carl Zimmer. And just one more question for you, Carl, which is, have you come to any conclusion about whether life is fragile and precious or robust and ordinary?
You know, the fact that we have not been contacted by any other living things in the universe makes me wonder if maybe life is rarer than we might otherwise think. And I think we should appreciate this wonderful thing that we definitely have on this planet, and work our best to preserve it in its diversity and complexity. And then who knows, maybe we'll be able to find it somewhere else eventually.
Lovely to talk to you today. I've been speaking with Carl Zimmer, award-winning New York Times science columnist, and his book is called Life's Edge, The Search for What It Means to Be Alive. Thanks, Carl.
Thank you.